you. We were Texas.
Meeting of the Senate Finance will please come to order. It is Tuesday, February 28th, 2012, and our first bill on the agenda is Senator Miller's bill, Senate File 1717. And we are waiting for the engrossed copy to come from the Jobs Committee, but we can start with an explanation of the bill.
Morning, Madam Chair and members.
Good morning, Senator Miller, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I understand, Madam Chair, that you kind of have a tight schedule. Do you want us to go through the whole bill quickly and then come back to the finance piece, or?
Senator Miller, we always like an explanation of the
be happy to.
An overview of the bill.
Okay. And I have Mr. Rakowski here from the Department of Labor and Industries. Do you want to go through it, or do you want me to? Okay.
Any questions if they have
them. I'll run through it quickly. Do you guys have anything in front of you on it or not?
Yes, we have the original.
You have the original. Okay. So I'm going to go through, Madam Chair, a version that we amended it in the Jobs Committee, and then I have a very quick amendment also, the A-12, that will move forward with when we get the version, the updated version in front of you. So basically, sections 1 through 10 make changes to the apprenticeship training provisions in compliance with federal requirements. And I'm not sure that that's in the bill that's in front of you. That's in the amendment. Section 11 deletes redundant language relating to issuance of licenses. And Madam Chair, maybe I should back up a little bit. This bill in front of us is a technical bill from the department, and it's been to the Jobs Committee already and passed, so I'll continue to go on here. Section 12 clarifies license fees and calculations to conform with a new fee structure enacted in 2010 and 2011. Section 13 has to do with agriculture buildings. It clarifies the definition of agriculture buildings by providing that a determination of agriculture land is made by a municipal or county assessor under the governing property tax law. And prior to this, it was made by the building official. Is that correct?
Sometimes.
And I spoke with county assessors, at least in my area, and they were okay with this language and actually preferred this language. Section 14, exemptions from licensing. And Section 15, the application, examination, and license fees. Basically, it updates references from plumber's apprentice to unlicensed individual. Section 16 repeals obsolete rules relating to the state building codes, and cleans up our statutes a little bit for basically regulations that are no longer needed. And that basically is the bill in a nutshell.
Mr. Rutusky, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm John Rutusky with the Department of Labor and Industry. Senator Miller was gracious enough to carry this bill, and even as you know, he's just had a recent birth, and so we've been juggling our schedule. So I actually testified on the bill, and then he testified on it, so I actually got two hearings in the Jobs Committee. We talked about the fiscal note when Senator Miller was in attendance, and can I have that bill, please? The fiscal note pertains, members, to sections 1 and 2 when... For those of you not intimately familiar with the Department of Labor and Industry, we regulate and issue licenses and permits for about 130,000 Minnesota individual contractors and business entities. So that's a lot of license renewals every year. And the fiscal note speaks to that because we anticipate in any given year about 1,000 or so startup companies, the vast majority of them in the residential building contractor occupations. And the second largest is in the electrical industry, where people, quote, hang out a shingle and then they apply for a license. So that is the new revenue piece that's clarified in the fiscal note. We anticipate about $32,000 in annual revenue. It's the churning of the industry. People retire. Their son takes over, Miller and Sons, for example. His dad might retire, and then he would be the license holder, you know, if he was an electrical contractor. So that explains the fiscal note if you're wondering where that special revenue source is.
Mr. Otuski, as I looked at this, I noticed that it's actually generating some additional funding, which does it goes to the general fund then, or is it's a special revenue fund?
Madam Chair, it's a special revenue fund. It's a fee for service. Senator Miller is an electrical contractor. He pays his license to the state of Minnesota, and in return for that, he expects timely and accurate inspections of his work and the issuance of permitting to do the work.
Mr. Otuski, do you happen to know what the fund balance of the fund is, the special revenue fund?
Madam Chair, when you look at when we do a biennial budget every 2 years, it's actually kind of interesting. Again, for those not real familiar with the agency, we perform four functions. We are the state-run OSHA plan, which gets some federal money and then some state money from actually this fund. We call it the Construction Code Fund. That's the term for the Special Revenue Fund. We do construction code and licensing. We do workers' compensation. And lastly, we do the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Program, which is the amendment that was just added to 1717. So when you see the budget bill, the workers' comp section is explained. So is Labor Standards and Apprentice. So is OSHA. But when you get to the construction code and licensing, it just lists about $22 million for the biennium, because it's the money we anticipate coming in from these 130,000 licensees and businesses, and then the money is used as a fee for service to do permitting and inspections.
Mr. Rotuski, does the fund build up a fairly significant balance? Is this one of the funds that had some money taken out of it because it had some surplus in it?
Madam Chair, my chief financial officer was here. She would admonish us on the word surplus because it's a fund balance to pay for the salaries of the roughly 130 people who work in that division. And like the state, we need to have about a three-month working balance, which is about $6 million we need at any given time for payroll purposes. That's what I've been told.
I just want to make sure that the fees that are charged for the new licenses that you're looking at are not going to generate additional funds that are unneeded for the service.
Well, Madam Chair, before the Great Recession and before this fund was consolidated, if I can go back to Governor Pawlenty did an executive order 5 years ago, which brought the Board of Electricity to the department. It had been a standalone, generating what you might call excess revenue, because electrical licenses and inspections is about a third of all the licensing and inspection that we do with the state. The residential building contractors had been regulated at the Department of Commerce. And for those of you who've been around for a while, you know that the building code folks have been part of the department administration forever. And at our department, since it seems like statehood, the boiler and high pressure piping functions were done at our department. Under that executive order, they put all five of those disciplines or functions under one roof, if you will, and created that one fund. And during the past decade, about $16 million has been transferred from this fund to the general fund. And I think you're aware that there's an actual statutory annual transfer of $1.5 million per year that began in 2007, and unfortunately the statute says in every year thereafter. And the previous administrations under Commissioner Swigum, we appealed to the governor's office on at least two occasions during his time as commissioner to repeal that, but it's still on the books. So there are transfers to the general fund, like many revenue funds, I'm sure, all over the state agencies.
And I do believe there's a bill that's been introduced to address that issue after the current biennium, that we would cease making that transfer, because it sounds like the fund is not going to have a lot of extra money in it, and then it would require perhaps an increase in the fees. Well, meanwhile, we're taking $1.5 million away from the fund, which we probably should not be doing.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The electrical industry, those lobbyists who represent them, refer to it as an extra tax on them because they're paying twice now.
Right.
I believe the bill, actually, one version of it, is in the Jobs Committee this morning.
Okay, and I'm sure we'll be hearing that as well. And, you know, that's why I'm concerned that we don't want these fees to be too high so that you build up what might be considered an excess and a future legislature might be tempted to pull it in for other purposes because those fees are supposed to be tied to the services that they're being charged for. And so
that's correct, Madam Chair. And we will be the department. I forgot one. The fifth one was the plumbers that came from the Department of Health. Sorry for those plumbers out there. They were also consolidated at our department. And they actually have, that's one of the things we cleaned up in the bill. We had the plumber's apprenticeship was a term of definition that they use at the Department of Health, but we use a term for the apprenticeship program. So we're still, even after all these years, still cleaning up references. So we've had a technical bill on this subject matter every year since the consolidation. Consolidations, mergers are tough, messy business. But I'll give you an example. To put a hand sink in a restaurant, the current law, we charge $400 for an inspection, which is out of whack. But yet, if we're inspecting sinks at Regents Hospital, for example, with their major addition, you know, where there's literally hundreds of plumbing inspections being done, the state caps it at like $1,800, which is doesn't cover it. So we're going to come back next year in a budget biennial year and try to balance out those fees for services so they actually pay for what the work is intended to do.
Yes, it's good if they make sense to people. $400 for an inspection for a sink doesn't make sense. And that's what makes people angry at government.
Yep.
Members, Senator Magnus.
I'm sure I'd like to offer the A12 amendment to the bill.
How kind of calls for it.
Yeah. Senator Miller, it looks like it's just a word change.
Yeah, but it's just a word change. If you look in line 2.27, we did the same thing. We're changing journeymen to journey workers, and I believe that's to comply with federal.
Department of Labor.
Department of Labor.
Okay. Any questions from members?
What's the amendment?
It's the A12 amendment.
It's the PC amendment.
It's just as changing the word journeyman to journey workers.
Journeyman, that's the one I just saw. Okay.
Any questions?
I'm ahead of you this time.
If not, all in favor of Senator Magnus' amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. And Senator Miller, any other comments?
Madam Chair, I just want the members of the record to reflect that I am not an electrical contractor. I am a small business owner, but not an electrical contractor.
And we do not regulate it either.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Miller, I see on page 3 that you're deleting, starting on line 26, you're deleting the sentence that says that the committee can have an apprentice as a member of the committee, and I'm wondering if you can tell us if this is an apprenticeship committee, why we're taking the reference to the apprentices out of the committee? Just out of curiosity.
Madam Chair, I'll let
Mr. Rutkowski, do you want to answer that?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, these were recommendations. We were told that we needed to make some language changes 2 years ago to conform with the federal apprenticeship program. As some of you know, the state of Minnesota has its own apprenticeship program, but it has to be certified by the Federal Department of Labor. So this probably is being stricken because it's antiquated term for the apprenticeship program. This was recommended by the federal government. That's all I can comment on.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Rutkowski,
Senator Higgins,
with this out of there, there still is, there no longer is anything that would keep the committee from having an actual apprentice on the committee. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's to my knowledge. We still require the 4 years, and so this must be duplicative language. That's
okay.
Why it was stricken.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions about the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry?
I just want to go back. Did I hear it right that they have a bank with $22 million in it? Is that, and they need $6 million for payroll? What are they doing with the rest? I mean, I'm trying to get a handle on if in fact this is an enterprise fund and that's the way it should be working, or if not, that surplus of money, should that not be in the general fund and issued out of that? I'm trying to get a handle on this big bulk of money here.
Well, and I wouldn't want to take it for the general fund because we have collected it on the premise that it's a fee for service.
Right, correct.
And that's why I'm concerned about if the fees are accurate, if we're charging the right amount so that we don't build up excessive surplus in that fund. And Mr. Rutkowski, do you want to answer that $22 million question?
$22 million question. Senator Perry brings up an excellent point, because before the consolidation, the boiler inspector function at the state and the high-pressure piping inspections brought in more money than was needed to perform the service. So my understanding from fiscal, and they might chime in here, and this was before my time working at the Department of Labor, but my understanding was the fees that they were generated from licenses and inspection revenue went to the general fund, and then it came back to the department for boiler and high-pressure piping in the form, I believe the term is an indirect appropriation. And this is kind of a policy debate, and we've been having it for most of this decade since the consolidation, because until the last 2 years, when the state was facing a deficit and the jobs committee got zero for a target, they would go look for pots of money. They would take it from the dislocated worker program, is another classic example of, you know, employers paying in for essentially a training service. It builds up the surplus, and then the money is taken and transferred to the general fund for other programs. It's conceivable. I'm not an elected official, but you could use that $22 million, put it in the general fund, and then appropriate $22 million back to the department, and that's our two-year budget. This is in lieu of the general fund, you know, to pay for salaries, pay for travel. The electrical code applies to the whole state, so we contract out to about 70 electrical contractors to do inspections all over the state, so these are some of the sources of where the money comes from. But if you'd like, I think I can get you a budget breakdown on how the two-year, where the money goes and where it's spent.
Senator Perry, our fiscal analyst, Brent Gustafson, has some information in front of him that he could share with us.
Madam Chair, members, Mr. Rutkowski is right in one regard, that the manner in which we budget fee collecting agencies could all be in the general fund. That revenue could be deposited in the general fund, and appropriation could be made from the general fund. But the structure of the construction codes account in the state government special revenue fund is to collect those fees and deposit them in the fund, and then the legislature in the biennial budget will appropriate to the Department of Labor Industry the money to operate the oversight and inspections. The budget for 2012 and 13 for the Department of Labor Industry is approximately $22 million a year, $22.5 million. So there's not a $22 million balance. It is a $22 million a year operation for labor and industry. I don't recall but could get the estimated balances at the end of this biennium and the end of the next. I don't recall it being $6 million. It might be. I thought it was perhaps in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 million at the end of the next biennium. And while Mr. Rakowski may be right that this fund, like any, has some modest cash flow ups and downs, that I don't believe this account would need to carry a balance for cash flow purposes.
Senator Perry?
That helps me, because it sounded like you didn't use it all. That's how I took it, that they were using about $6-7 million a year, and I'm wondering what was going on, but or biennium, however that works out. But if in fact they do roll through this money every biennium, correct? That's what I'm understanding. One final question: are there built-in fee increases in this? I was looking for that. No.
Mr. Rutowski.
No, this is a, Madam Chair, Senator Perry, this is a technical bill. There are no fee increases in it.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions about Senate File 1717? If not, Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 1717 be passed.
Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, as amended.
Amended, right, as amended.
Senator Magnus moves that Senate File Number 1717 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent placed on general orders. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Our next bill on the agenda is Senator Peterson. It's Senate File 1524. Welcome, Senator Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This morning we have before you Senate File 1524. It's a bill that relates specifically to the Board of Engineering here in the state of Minnesota. It's a policy bill that relates specifically to engineers. The board also regulates architects, landscape architects, land surveyors, geologists, as well as interior designers. This committee handles the general appropriations for that board, and this board just makes some policy changes in the areas of ethics, education specifically. It also strengthens the Practice Act, as well as some issues surrounding interior designers, as well as some of the services that the board provides, and then, of course, some obsolete language, or just some simple housekeeping issues. This policy bill does result in some savings for the state in the tune of about $30,000 to $35,000. You'll be hearing some testimony about. But here today to present this case to you, we have Ms. Christine Cubes, who's a board member. She'll talk about some of the provisions of the bill, and then we have Ms. Doreen Frost, who currently is the executive director of the board, and we're grateful to have their expertise for you this morning.
Thank you. And Ms. Frost, did you want to go first?
Madam Chair, I'm Christine Cubes.
Oh, you're Christine.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Senator Peterson. And good morning, members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am a public member and the immediate past chair of the Board of Licensure. And I'm accompanied today, in addition to our executive director, Ms. Frost, by other members of the board. The board we represent, as Senator Peterson mentioned, governs and licenses the design professionals of the state. Your materials that you have in front of you contain a summary of the different changes. I'm not going to go through them point by point as your summary, given that you can read your summary. I'm just going to give you a few highlights to expedite matters. The Senate File 1524 in front of you covers five main areas. Briefly, it strengthens and clarifies the Practice Act, by limiting the use of PE only by professional engineers. It dedicates 2 out of the required 24 hours of continuing education to ethics and requires licensees to keep their continuing education paperwork for 4 years rather than 2 to help them basically support the fact that they've completed their education if they undergo an audit. It cleans up obsolete language, eliminates past dates or references to old accrediting bodies that no longer exist. Just cleans that up while we were at it. We thought we'd do a bit of housekeeping. And finally, it directly relates to the fiscal note. It provides fees for services rendered. We were just discussing fees for services on your other bill. We also have a few that we need to attend to. First, it sets a $75 application fee for our certified interior designers of the state. Currently, just by a legislative oversight some years ago, certified interior designers pay no application fee, even though review of their files for application takes as much time as any of the other professionals governed by the board. So we would like to correct that. We're setting a $25 fee for the verification of records for licensees who apply for licensure in other states. As you're well aware, many architects and engineers in particular are licensed in many states. They practice in many states. And each time that a Minnesota licensee goes to another state, that state will reach over to Minnesota and say, hello, I have the file for Ms. Cubes in another state. Would you please verify their credentials in Minnesota? And that process takes 1 full day a week of staff time every week, and yet we don't have any fee assessed for that review. So we would recommend a $25 fee, and that I would say is consistent with our neighboring states and actually kind of right in the middle. There are $15 fees, there are $35 fees. We pick $25 just for a good round number. We're also setting $100 fee per exam administered by the board. There are several exams that the board itself administers on behalf of the national councils that write the exams. And for that time, we thought it would be appropriate for a $100 fee. And I also would note to the committee that these fees are not increases. They are fees that have not yet existed for services that are provided. I thank you for your attention to that policy detail, and now I'll yield the floor to our executive director to speak to the fiscal note. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Frost.
Good morning. I'd just like to indicate the number of licensees that we have and add just a point of clarification on some of the fees, and the fiscal note is before you, and I'll be happy to sit for questions. In the state of Minnesota, for the professions that we currently regulate, we have over 18,000, almost closer to 19,000 licensees. The three fees that are set out, we've been discussing with various groups. The application for certified interior designers, actually CIDs send in money, and we have to refund it because they just assume that there's an application fee that's similar for other licensees. For the verifications, I want to add one point of clarification. It is not simply going online and seeing if someone is currently licensed. There are two groups. One are the Minnesota licensees that are seeking licensure in other states, but also the state of Minnesota, like any other state, is required to keep any initial exam. So when someone is taking one portion of the exam and successfully completes that, we have a record retention schedule that is permanent. And so we have a high number of verifications that are from people that are not licensed in Minnesota and may never have gotten licensed, but they may have taken their fundamentals exam in the state of Minnesota, and we must verify that to the state along with exam scores, date of licensure, any enforcement history, resolution of enforcement history. And so it's not merely checking to see if a licensee is current and in good standing. So that fee for services is currently paid out of the licensing fee that we currently have, but there is not a fee for service on that. The exam administration, I want to let you know that numerous exams are done on computer-based exam, and there's only a few that are still paper-based, and that is the small number that you see before us. Currently, the board is absorbing all of those expenses when they administer that exam, and there is not an exam administration fee. So those are points of clarification that I want to bring to your attention. And then the fiscal note speaks for itself. It would be a small amount that would be generated. All of our licensing fees, as well as these current fees, would go into the general fund, and we would be coming back and asking for appropriations.
So, members, this is just the opposite of the fund that we saw in the previous bill. This one goes to the general fund and is reappropriated by us to them for their services. And the other one actually went into a special revenue fund. So are there any questions about the fiscal note? So, Ms. Frost, when it says that we'll have $29,000 in additional revenue, but that money you feel is justified and needed for the services that are being provided?
Senator Roebling, members of the committee, absolutely. Really, currently, the services are absorbing, like I said, one full staff person. And just to bring to your attention, we have a tiny staff. We have a tiny staff of 6 employees for this amount. And it sometimes generates overtime just to get the work done for this one service. It is definitely a fee for services, and it's only when needed, either by our licensees or people from without the state. The other thing is that I want to bring to your attention is when a licensee or an applicant is wanting this verification, they want it yesterday because they perhaps have a job pending or they have an application pending. And with various budget cuts across the country, many state licensing boards don't meet every month as they did in history. So this is a very quick turnaround. The staff is required to process it within 7 days upon receiving it. It also requires a hard copy pull for some of these archaic files to actually go get exam scores. And that is required for initial licensure in another jurisdiction. It's definitely a fee for service.
Any questions? Senator Bonham?
Madam Chair, and I apologize, I had to step out briefly, so if some things were said that was covered as I stepped out. As part of the Sunset Commission overview, we've been looking at many health licensing boards and commissions, and I'm wondering about the structure of this particular board. Do you take advantage of the various administrative helps that other boards and commissions? There's a group called the Administrative ASU. I forget what it stands for. Do you take part in that?
Ms. Frost?
Senator Roebling, Senator Bonoff, and members of the committee. Yes, I'm actually not in that space. However, a couple of things. First of all, I attend those meetings on a regular basis. I don't have their shared services. I've contracted with the Department of Commerce for some of those shared services. So we have a combined, those are the ASU have to do with the health licensing boards, which I attend monthly, just to brainstorm if nothing else. We already do shared services. As you know, this board has the 7 professions, which are all different professions. And then I am 0.5 to this licensing board and 0.5 to the Board of Accountancy, which has another 18,000. So shared services, one of the good things about having to know so many things is that you don't have the luxury of not knowing some of the information. So, yes, I do shared services. I also work with Office of Enterprise Technology. Some of the things that we have done at our agency are actually used by the ASU, and that's part of the purpose of the executive directors getting together. I do not pay for their shared services because I'm not in their same space. I actually have a contracted space less than those per square footage. I've just gone through that. And we are located at the Golden Rule Building rather than on University Avenue.
Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, just as follow-up, I know in addition some of the other boards use SMART, which is part of the Department of Admin. So it sounds like you have a system that's working for you, but I just also want to encourage you, should you need any additional help, SMART is working closely with the Department of OET to make sure that as the consolidation goes forward that they're wanting to be of service in that process as well.
Ms. Frost.
Senator Roebling, I'm Senator Bonoff. Thank you for the great idea. I have used SMART in the past and have been disappointed in it, to be quite honest. And I currently am sitting on the e-licensing committee appointed and working with OET closely, and we've also participated in the lien process. The lien process we've done. Most of the things, as you may not have some people on this committee may not have the history. It's just been a few years ago, actually 6 years ago, that the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design merged the back office system with the Board of Accountancy. Both still remain as standalone agencies, and so we've done most of the SPART implementation and taken the budget cuts thereafter. We have shared equipment. We have cross-training between staff, which was allowed by the legislative audit, and we share most services already. And so it is a really great resource if you've just started on that path. And it's something that, you know, the bottom line is the state employees sometimes are under a lot of heat for not working effectively. But when you have a small office, you don't have any place to hide, and you must get your work done, and you have to work smarter. And I am blessed with an excellent staff mm-hmm. that come to the table with ideas, and we're constantly improving. That's part of our goal.
Senator Bono.
Well, Madam Chair, and this is a final comment. So sounds like you have some lessons that you've learned over the years that could actually be helpful. We have a reform and redesign committee. And in particular, at some point, I'd love to hear about your experience with SMART to make sure that we're structuring that in the best way possible. And I'm sure that Commissioner Spencer Cronk would want to hear about anything that wasn't working as well, so we can follow up offline on that. Thank you.
I'd be honored.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is for counsel. I'm concerned about the establishment of this board, and I understand that it probably goes back to 1921, as Mr. Bonnardon was showing me here, but I'm seeing different names in the establishment of this new board, and I get concerned when we start moving members, increasing them, decreasing them, changing what appears to be, in my mind, by reading this, the names and which would lead to maybe different organizations being involved on this board. And I know it hasn't come through state gov. So I'm looking at Mr. Bodern. Should this make another stop to take a look at the makeup of this board and who they're adding and subtracting to?
Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, if you look at Section 2 of the bill, page 2, lines 26 through 34, strike some language that is, at this point, obsolete. It relates to major changes that were made in the composition of the board, I think, in 1995. And all the language here relates to the length of terms for some of the new members on the board at that time. And even on line 34, the board was temporarily allowed to expand to 23 members. But that language is all historical now and obsolete and therefore not needed in the statutes at this time. I think the board, the composition of the board, the number of members, their terms, et cetera, those are all in law already, and they're not changed in this bill.
Ms. Cubes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Perry, your staff has responded. I just wanted to say that we're not changing the composition or opening or adding or anything, the bill or the board. We're simply cleaning up the language in the act.
So,
Senator Perry.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, what you're saying is that the terms, the rotation, everything is staying the same. Because when you see here, and we're talking about Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, the only three names in the old section was Geoscience, Interior Design, and Landscape Architecture. So that's why I question: are we adding three new, and I'm hearing we're not, that it's...
Right. Senator Perry, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is no such change happening at this time. The composition of the board is not changing. You're probably suffering from the fact that there's just, you know, you're seeing bits and pieces of the bill that are being explained to you. But as a collective whole, I think we could affirmatively say there's no change being made to the board itself. That is not the point of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, how long has this board of five different professions been together? Did they originally start out, you know, as the Board of Architecture and then the Board of Interior Design and or whoever, and then, you know, all came together at some point? They must have.
Ms. Frost.
Senator Roebling, good morning, Senator Higgins.
Hi.
This board has had professions added to it over the years. The last professions that were added were in 1995. The administrative rules were put in 1996. And to answer Mr. Perry's question, at that time there were temporary assignments on board members. And the board at that time was 23. It has since gone to 21. Back in the early 1920s, you had architects and engineers and land surveyors on one board. Over the history then, you have in the late 1970s, you added landscape architects, which is not the same as landscaping, and landscape architects. And then the actually certified interior designers came on, and then what we call geoscientists. And to be really clear, they're clarified in administrative rules. And geoscientists are professional geologists, of which there are over 600. We have a high mining industry in this state, obviously, and professional soil scientists. Those were both added in 1995. With administrative rules then written in 1996. We have a 21-member board. They meet 8 to 9 times a year. They're very effective. They break out in committees by discipline so that some of the specific work for those professions is done in committee and then brought to the full board.
Thank you.
And of course, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins?
Interior designers are not interior decorators.
And that is affirmed. Are there any other questions about 1524? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cubes? In looking at the first engrossment on page 6, it indicates that all fees, all of these fees that we're talking about on line 6 are non-refundable. Would there not be situations in which someone who is applying to the board for some kind of service where a refund of the fee would not be or would be appropriate? I mean, it looks like you're giving yourself absolutely no leeway to take into consideration changing circumstances or the vagaries in life that occur to everybody.
Ms. Coombs.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I'll yield the floor to Ms. Frost to answer that question, the Executive Director. Thank you.
Ms. Frost.
Sorry. Senator Roebling, Senator Newman, and members of the committee, there are times when refunds are done. It is typically not after service has been rendered. It will be someone who is making an application who decides they don't have all their ducks in a row and have an incomplete application before the board has started to process them. People make incorrect fees. I sign refunds on a regular basis. It is typically not after service has been given or rendered. And in these cases, verification, the fee needs to be collected up front. We don't want to be in the position of having to collect the fees after the services are given. And since all of these are directly requesting service, if the service hadn't been rendered or incorrect fees are made, we do have the capabilities for refunds.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But if I'm reading, and maybe I'm reading the bill incorrectly, the latitude that you were granted in the past where you did refund fees is now going to be prohibited under on page 6, line 6.
That is correct, with the exceptions of withdrawing an application, because then there is no application pending. They withdraw it. And that's always been allowed. That didn't need to be spelled out in statute. But the verification for fee for services and exam administration, you are correct, sir. We would not have the leeway to do that.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? If not, Senator Bonoff?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I do have one more question. Have you ever been in a situation, given that you charge fees, I know this is a new added group that you hadn't charged fees before, where your fees have been, you've built up a surplus and they've been taken and that surplus has been repurposed for the general fund?
Ms. Frost, do you recall any incident like that?
Senator Roebling, Senator Bonoff, our fees go to the general fund and our appropriations do not match what comes back out. That has been as a result of hiring freezes, merging of agencies where we've saved money, and to be Yes, of course. We bring in more than comes back to us, but that has been the nature of the animal for the last 8 years of fees going into the general fund and then requesting the appropriations.
Senator Bonner.
Well, Madam Chair, and I don't know if you followed what we've been actually writing with the Sunset Commission, but we have put a provision in with our recommendations, and I believe in the subsequent bill, that would forbid in that case that from happening. So we'll have to figure out a way to, you know, in a situation where the fees go to the general fund, where there isn't some kind of a dedicated fund, that those who pay in can have the assurance that that isn't happening, because I don't think that that, again, that leads to distrust of government. So I appreciate that.
Ms. Ross.
Senator Roebling, Senator Boniff, bravo.
Any other questions? Otherwise, I think we're ready to move the bill. Senator Newman.
One last question. If the fees go into the general fund and historically you receive back less than what you pay in, why are we being asked to support a bill where there's going to be a fee increase of $35,000? Or am I misunderstanding completely?
Ms. Frost.
Senator Roebling, Senator Newman, you raise a good issue. However, we're looking at two different things. One is a fee for services. Yes, this agency operates on the appropriation by the amount that is raised by the licensees, but if you're going to have the system going forward, then you're also going to need to have a fee for services, and this is for something that is not necessarily a service that any of the Minnesota, a smaller amount of Minnesota PEs and architects ask for verifications than people coming from not within the state boundaries that need licensures in other jurisdictions because of the animal that is created with exam administration and having a requirement to keep permanent records. So it is a fee for services. Yes, a separate issue is, do we generate more in our licensing fees than our appropriations? Yes. But we've also been on a hiring freeze, and we will be asking for staff needs going forward.
So, Ms. Frost, this is something that next year when we're working on the budget and their request comes in higher than it was the previous biennium, we need to take into consideration that they are generating more fees because they believe they have more needs for staffing to cover that. That's something that will be considered next year in the budget. Any other questions? Otherwise, Senator Ingebertson moves that Senate File 1524 be recommended to pass. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Senator Peterson. Our final bill for today is back to Senate File 1567, which we will take off the table. Laid on the table last Thursday when a fiscal note came in right before the committee hearing, and we needed a little more time to review it. And so Senator Ingebertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 1567 has been worked on considerably since the last time we met. A fiscal note is what obviously we needed to address. And I will allow, we have an amendment to address that. It's the A8 amendment. I think you may have them in your packets. I guess they have to be.
The A7?
Oh,
is this bill again?
Yes. A8, Madam Chair.
A8?
Madam Chair, just
Senator Newman.
Just so that I can follow, we are going to be dealing with an A8 amendment, not an A7.
That's correct.
That's correct. And the one that's in your pack, the A7, was
it's coming up.
Last one.
Mr. Bodern will help explain the A7.
Madam Chair and members, the A7 is basically an engrossment of the A6 amendment with the oral changes that were incorporated at the last hearing when this bill was taken up. There's no need for the committee to take action on the A7 amendment. It simply reflects what has already occurred to date at the last hearing. and it's an effort to make it a little easier to understand what happened. There was, however, a small oversight, and again, there's no need for committee action on this, but if you look at on the A7, page 1, line 15, after House, it should have of, so that when it's engrossed, it will read House of Representatives. But again, the A7 is here just so the committee can understand what it has already done.
Okay, but now we want to look at the A8.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'll turn it over to Mr. Knopf here for explanation of the amendment. It's pretty straightforward. If you'd like to follow along, he'll explain the amendment, Madam Chair.
Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair, the amendment has two parts to it. On lines 1.2 to 1.4, remove the appeal process for the permit application. That was a large number in the fiscal note, I think around $270,000, if I remember right. And so that's being removed in lines 1.2 to 1.4. 1.5 to 1.9, this deals with the deed assessment for the permit coordinator. And what this does is it allows the department to establish a fee schedule to assess the costs. And it makes it clear that they're allowed to have a fee schedule to assess. Under the current language in the bill, it just says to assess for the cost. And then the current bill also would allow the money to be used by other agencies. It's my understanding that the way this is going to work is that it's basically to pay for the department's cost of administering the coordinator. And so it's changed so the money is appropriated directly to the Department of Employment and Economic Development directly. Any money that they recover through this fee schedule to assess the project proposer for the coordination activities. And this just makes some minor changes into how that fee is assessed and that it's going to be used by deed for the coordinator.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, does this amendment then pay for the fiscal note?
Yes, Senator it does, but I'd like to have Mr. Mueller explain that, make it very clear what it does.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, what I'll do quickly here is a walk through. There's a new revised fiscal note that should be in your packet. It's S-1567-2ER. And what this is reflected of, the PCA basically came back and took about $75,000 off their cost. And that starts on page 6. You'll see the PCA's part. The previous fiscal note was about $360,000 in fiscal year 13. And they had some fiscal year 12 costs, too, that are now out of it. What the amendment is doing is actually taking that 291 number in fiscal year 13 and dropping that by $272,000. So what's left to PCA will only be about $19,000 in fiscal year 13 and $9,000 in 14 and 15. So the amendment takes out the appeal process, which was by far the biggest cost driver in the fiscal note. So there is small amounts left by DNR, PCA, and MDOT that are less than in the $10,000 to $20,000 range of costs in this bill that are still there.
Senator Stump, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, my question was answered.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to page 5, why would we, where then, if you're taking 5.31 through 5.33 out, where does a person go that feels they've been aggrieved? How do they appeal this? What avenue do they have?
District court.
To whoever wants to answer that.
Well, Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, this is just for the application itself. It's not for the permit. The permit decisions on the permit can be appealed under current law. And so basically we would leave current law stand for any appeals on this. This was a specific provision dealing with when they disagree after 30 days on the application. It means that they basically – disagree on the application at that point. And they can use any normal appeals process. They could appeal to the Pollution Control Agency board, or whatever existing law appeals process. But again, this is the thought was that there was a large cost in the fiscal note, and that this process probably wouldn't be used. Just on a difference of opinion on the application, you wouldn't take it to the appeals court.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, some of the issues that I've heard of is that seems to be a problem, is that a person will get an application and start on the process only to be told that they're not working on the application properly, and this seems to be just taking out, if a person feels they've been aggrieved through the application process, their right to appeal it.
Mr. Quillis?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Senator Perry, thank you for your question. If you'll go back to the earlier, I think it's Section 1 for DNR and Section 5 for PCA, we are addressing some of that in the bill previously, where we're talking about the 150-day goal and whether or not one of the hindrances that we've had in the application process is whether or not the application has been substantially complete or not and when that clock starts. So we're trying to clarify that with the agency, that when we submit an application, that the clock will start. And so that if there is a debate on whether the application is complete or not and it doesn't meet the 150-day goal, it will be so duly noted in the two reports that they do on February 1st and August 1st. As regards to if we would go through to appeal, we've had some debate with the agency on whether or not, just on an application, if we would go through a project proposer, would go all the way to the Court of Appeals on that. Normally, some of the applications that could be rejected could be just due to forgetting to submit a check or lack of information. We could just submit that very quickly, and we wouldn't appeal if the application was rejected for something along those lines. We wouldn't keep going for along those lines, but and go to the Court of Appeals. But we would just correct that and just keep going, and the clock would still keep going. And we think within the existing law right now involving an administrative law judge, if we wanted to go through that, there is existing law that we don't need to have that language, that there are certain systems right now that we could use to appeal the application.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Quillis. Excuse me. Please excuse my unfamiliarity with the basics of this, but is there a mechanism in place, either currently or in this bill, which would allow an applicant to start the 150-day clock running?
Yes.
Mr. Quillis?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when the application is submitted to the Pollution Control Agency, if this bill would become law, the clock starts.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions? Senator Perry.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. So the clock starts. Is there anything in here that creates the stoppage of that clock between day one and 150?
Mr. Quillis?
Madam Chair, previously there was, but if this bill became law, there wouldn't be any stoppage. If somebody went beyond the 150-day, an application went beyond the 150-day goal, then it would be duly noted in the report that the PCA would submit. But otherwise, that's what we're trying to clarify. We had project proposers submit applications. They were then subsequently returned to the project proposer for various reasons, and the clock would stop. But we're just trying to make sure that the clock, it's clarifying that the clock starts when we go through. And then the two reports will show. If it is the project proposer's fault, it will show in the reports that we've had go through.
And since 150 days is actually just a goal with a report that follows up as to whether or not it was achieved, if it is the project proposer's fault they couldn't process the application because it was missing too much information, that would also be duly noted?
Madam Chair, yes. I think they've had, um, I think in the application process, I think, is there five or six reasons that we've grouped down to why the applications have been rejected. And the key here is being able to, and it's just started. I think we've just got the first full report. We had a half of one and then the first full report. The key is starting to collect this data and to why, if they are rejected, and as to why. It might point the finger at the project proposer, and then we need to figure out why we're submitting incomplete applications. And it might also find another area where we can go through and find some efficiencies and help the agency streamline in processing these as they go through the system.
Now, you're still planning to have the pre-application meetings so that the applicant understands what it takes to fill out the application?
That is correct, upon request of the agency.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Senator Higgins?
I'd like to hear if there's anybody from the Pollution Control Agency from DNR who can give us an update on their work with this and if they're feeling that this is workable and they're now supportive of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thanks for letting me speak today. One point of clarification, once the clock starts, it never stopped. What's changed under this these modifications is when the clock officially starts. Right now, upon our interpretation of the law, and actually what makes sense, is that the clock would start upon submission of a complete application. If I can, I'll give you a little example. If you were to go to eBay and order something online without giving your mailing address, but eBay had made a promise to submit or to mail that item to you within 7 days, if you didn't give your mailing address, would you still hold eBay accountable for sending you the thing within 7 days? And the answer is no, you didn't give all the information. So for the PCAs, from our perspective, the clock should start upon the determination from the PCA that the application is complete. It fulfills the obligation of the applicant to give us sufficient information so that we can dedicate the resources to work on the permit itself versus the back and forth. In many cases, especially for very complicated projects, we go through many months of applicants not clear about what it is they want to do. They know they want to build a project, but they're unclear exactly what they want to build. They haven't necessarily got the resources to do it, and therefore often give to us incomplete applications. Our job as the agency is to let the applicants know exactly what's required to be complete. So that's one thing we've worked on very hard in the last year to try to update. And it's their obligation to give us the complete information so that we can begin working on the application to meet the 150-day goal. The problem with the legislation as it's crafted on that 150-day goal starting point is now, yes, we're tracking the data, but it has no responsibility on the permit applicant in terms of the 150-day goal to give us complete information. We think that's a problem.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, forgive me, because I think I'm hearing two different answers to the same question. And so my question is, what happens when there is a legitimate dispute between the PCA and the applicant as to whether or not the application is complete, which then starts the clock running?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, there is a number of appeal processes. One is an appeal to our commissioner's office. There's also an appeal process to our citizens board, if there's concerns about that. And then there's also an appeal process to a normal legal, through the normal legal routes. So they could take it to an ALJ, or it could be sued out in state courts. So there are processes by which they could make that appeal. I think our concern with this particular provision is that it clears the way for a permit professional to tie up permits and applications in the appellate court, and therefore slowing down the overall process. And you know, let's walk through this scenario if you will indulge me for just a second. An applicant who does not know, let's say, the air permitting process would hire a permit professional. They would assume that the permit professional is doing all they can do and has sufficient knowledge to work on this application. The permit professional, if they're taking bids for a project, they might go through three or four or five different bids, and they'll maybe select the lowest bid from a permit professional. The permit professional who submits an incomplete application to the agency and determined to be so from us might then feel inspired to take us to court because they feel like their professional responsibility or their professional, they've somehow feel like they were unfairly treated. So our concern about this particular provision is that you're clearing the way for a permit professional to take us to task and tie up a permit in the appellate court. And that seems like it's not in the best interest of the permittee when, in most cases, we can resolve permit application concerns within through just a few conversations and meetings, which is how we do this normally.
Mr. Smith, wouldn't the permittee get rid of the permit professional who would be tying it up and delaying the project?
Madam Chair, I hope that's the case, but this is untested in our normal process right now.
Okay. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering whether, it sounds like Mr. Smith's comments are a good caution to us to rethink the substantial, we took out throughout the process the substantially complete language. And from the sounds of it, that's a good caution that we maybe should think about whether that's what we actually should do. I mean, I think that the proposer of a project has an obligation to, put in a complete project or a substantially complete project or, whatever application. You could foresee the worst possible effect by having somebody come in and put their name and address and the address of where the project is and kind of not much more information. But if they turned it in, that would start the clock running. Well, seems like what the process has been is there's been a lot of give and take and working back and forth before in those preliminary meetings to get the application to a point at which when it goes in, it is substantially complete, and then the clock starts. I'm not sure that we're doing anybody a favor by just saying you can turn in any old thing and that the clock starts running, because that's, I think, what we're doing.
Well, Senator Higgins, I think, though, that we do have a process by which we can note that it wasn't in the form that the PCA would have expected it to be. And so if they don't meet the 150-day goal, that will be noted. And that's what we're going to have to pay attention to. If that develops into a major problem, that they're seeing a lot of incomplete applications and then thereby not making their 150-day goal, then we'll have to go back and address that somehow. But I think that what they're trying to get at is they want to keep the process moving. There's something that the PCA finds incomplete, correct me if I'm wrong, then the applicant is asking, let us know and we'll submit it as quickly as we can and we'll keep this moving rather than not starting it at all. And so is that your intent, Senator Ingebertson, in doing it this way?
Madam Chair, there is, I think you'll find, and I think the PCA has been very cooperative here, incidentally. They've been, working real hard with this bill like it did with what turned out to be law last year on House File 1. And, I don't think anybody's going to sit here and say that there isn't enough safeguards in place to stop something that's coming forward that doesn't make any sense. And that's not our intent at all. Our intent is just to make sure that it forces folks to pay attention to it, and if it's a good project, it moves forward and doesn't keep running into roadblocks. But at the same time, I think the MPCA still has the final say on the permitting process, and And that's stuff that we've gone over for an awful long period of time here. And I don't know, maybe Tony can Mr. Quillis can add to that, but it's not our intent to try and sneak through anything or harm anything at all. It's the intent to do it in a more streamlined fashion that makes sense. That's why we got rid of the, and I think it was agreed upon in a bipartisan fashion last year to get rid of the district court step and go right to the Court of Appeals. So.
And so, Senator Ingebrigtsen, just for clarification, if the 150-day goal is not met, and we heard last time that it's met about 90% of the time maybe now, is are we up to that percent?
Madam Chair, it depends on the kind of permits, but for all the permits that we've received applications for in the last year, we're about 81% within 150 days.
But it doesn't automatically trigger the permit approval. It's a goal, so no one can sneak anything past by running out the clock, because it's a goal to try and get those done in 150 days. So it's still to their benefit to cooperate, because they won't get the permit until you're satisfied that everything is in order. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I guess my only I don't want to mischaracterize the good work that we've done over the last couple of years trying to streamline the permit process. We have worked very effectively with the legislature and the Chamber of Commerce, and it's been, and even this bill has gone through significant revisions to make it certainly much, much better in the last month or so. So we appreciate the Chamber listening and considering the PCA's perspective. On your particular point, though, it's important to understand that we are happy to give you all the data that you would like. Part of the permanent efficiency bill from last March was that we were going to better collect and report on data. We will continue to give that data to you to show where incomplete applications have been received. But tying it to the 150-day mark, again, most folks, and I spend a lot of my time talking with companies and organizations that represent companies, are focused on the 150-day as a goal independent of the quality of the application. So while you're correct, we are the keepers of the decision whether an application is complete or incomplete. I worry about the perspective that getting to the point where an application complete is more of their work, the permittee's work, than the agency's work. We are there to help them through meetings and conversations and phone calls whenever they need it. But linking that data 250 days, I think, gives a slightly skewed perspective out in the business community. I would rather, from our perspective, we'd rather have the 150 days start as it is currently defined in this law, which is the submission and the determination that an application is complete, because then we get to focus the necessary resources on getting this thing done.
Senator Newman, did you have a question?
No, just a comment, Madam Chair. The reason why I've been asking some of these questions is because I do have some constituents who are having a great deal of difficulty with the PCA in obtaining permits for projects in my district. And as I listen to the PCA complimenting themselves on how well they work with private business and that they are there to help, I can tell you that I'm not buying into it completely. I am aware of problems with the PCA in my district with private business, and the permits have been delayed significantly longer than 150 days. So I just make that comment because I think it's important that the PCA recognize that there are individuals in the private sector that are indeed having difficulty with the PCA, and I would just ask that you be aware of it and deal with those in the private sector that are attempting to get these permits, and I'm talking about significant projects that will employ a lot of people and spend a lot of money in the private sector. So I just urge you to, you know, think about what I have said, because there are some difficulties with between the PCA and private industry.
Are there any other questions?
They haven't adopted the amendment.
Jennifer just pointed that out. We still have the A8 amendment in front of us. Senator Perry moves the A, or Senator Ingebrigtsen can move his own amendment, I guess. I'm sorry. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A8 amendment. Any questions on it? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And if there's no other discussion, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I would then, Madam Chair and members, move Senate file 1567 as amended to pass and move directly to the floor.
On Senator Ingebrigtsen's motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And with no other business before the committee, we will adjourn, but do pay attention tomorrow when the new fiscal forecast comes out. We will have more to talk about after that. The meeting is adjourned.